I think so.
Okay, we are back on the record. It is 10:05 a.m. Central Time. And at this time, we're going to proceed with the next witness. I believe that is Charles King, Mr. Norrell.
Yes, Your Honor, that is correct.
All right, and do you have an opening statement for Mr. King?
Yes, Your Honor.
I'd be sworn first. Okay.
You want to pass that out at this time, please?
Sure.
All right, thank you. And you've been present when I've instructed as to penalties for perjury. Okay, please speak up nice and loudly, and maybe if you can move that microphone a little closer to you. Thank you. Please raise your right hand. Do you solemnly swear the testimony you're about to give shall be the truth under pains and penalties of perjury?
I do.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, and what you've passed out is an opening statement of Charles King, labeled PSC 17, and by stipulation, this is admitted into the record.
Thank you.
All right, please proceed, Mr. Norrell.
Mr. King, you'll be testifying to PSC Exhibit 3, is that correct?
I assume so. I didn't know that had that designation, but
okay. That's marked as the direct testimony and exhibits of Charles W.
Okay.
King. Do you have any corrections that you need to make on the record to your?
No,
testimony?
I do not.
Okay. With that, has the witness been sworn?
Yes, he has.
Oh, I apologize.
Okay,
Mr. King, you may proceed with your opening statement. Thank you.
Good morning. My name is Charles King. I'm here representing the advocacy staff on the subject of rate of return. I recommend a return on equity of NSP for NSP's North Dakota rate base of 9%. The basis of this recommendation is set forth in my testimony and exhibits. The reasons why I arrive at 9% while Mrs. Bulkley arrives at 10.25% are listed in the last pages of my testimony, and I will not repeat them here. The company's response to my recommendation essentially boils down to two points. First, that interest rates are increasing, and second, that 9% is way below the return awards being granted by two other utilities. Mrs. Bulkley would have you believe that interest rates are skyrocketing. That's something of an exaggeration. Here are the numbers. In July, the average yield on a 30-year Treasury bond was 3.61%. Last week, it was 3.87%. Higher, but hardly skyrocketing. In July, the BAA-rated corporate bonds were yielding 5.32%. Last week, they were at 5.55%. Again, hardly a skyrocketing increase. Ms. Bulkley admits that as interest rates increase, the spread between bond yields and stock returns narrows. If that's the case, then the 20-point increase in interest rates translates to a much smaller increase in ROE requirements. Ms. Bulkley also points to forecasts of much higher interest rates, with long-term treasuries over 5% in a few years. The problem here is that analysts have been forecasting the interest rate increases for years, and they have yet to materialize. The Federal Reserve has made clear that it will not allow interest rates to increase significantly until the unemployment rate falls below 6%. Sadly, we are still a long way from that goal. The company has placed its greatest emphasis on the second objection. The 9.0% would be lower than all but one return awarded in the last year and a half. In my testimony, I guard against relying on other commissions' returns on the grounds it makes regulations circular. Decisions based on other decisions do not allow for objective evidence that departs from the conventional wisdom of the regulatory community. My response to NSP's complaint is twofold. First, objective evidence does indicate that the appropriate return is well below the average of the allowed returns during the past year. And second, objective evidence also suggests the average awarded return is too high. The objective evidence supporting lower return is in my testimony. I did not invent a single number in that testimony and exhibit. Every number came from outside objective sources that have no interest in skewing the equity returns up or down. Those numbers show quite clearly that a return of approximately 9% is all that investors require at this time. The objective evidence that is currently allowed returns are unnecessarily high is found in my exhibit CWK2, Schedule 4, page 2, and I would hope you could turn to that if you could. I'm sorry to pull this on you. I should have. I have it here. If you'd like me to pass it to you.
I'm good.
Is this your direct testimony?
I only have one testimony. So it's a direct testimony. It's the exhibit to it. See, there's two exhibits, CWK2, CWK1, and this is CWK2.
Page 1?
Yep. And I focus on column C, market-to-book ratio. That column shows the ratios of the market price of each. Oh, and it's page 2, not page 1 of Schedule 4.
Okay, now which exhibit was it?
CWK2.
Okay.
Schedule 4, page 2.
Schedule 4.
See, you can zoom on the iPad for the font, just so you know.
Right.
Yeah, once I get the hang of the dang thing. But look at this. Whoop, whoop. It's the wrong schedule.
Setting isn't set right on this. Not much help unless you can see sideways.
Okay, we're good.
Are we good?
Yep.
Take a look at column C. This column shows it's labeled market to book ratio, and it shows the ratio of the current market price of each company's stock to the book value of each company's stock. And it's relevant because ROE awards are applied to the book value of plant. Now, if regulators are granting the exact return on book equity that investors require, then the amounts that investors are willing to pay for the company's stock should be equal to book value. But it isn't. In every case, the returns on book value are such that investors are bidding the market value of the utility stocks well over their book value. In XL's case, the market value is 153% of its book value, but they run as high as 225%. That persistent excess of market over book value indicates quite clearly that utility returns exceed considerably the minimum requirements of investors. The 10% that regulators have been granting is clearly excessive. Now, you've been told that a 9% return award will result in North Dakota being downgraded as an investor-unfriendly regulatory environment. Now, this challenge raises a question of your responsibility. Are you responsible to the investor community to provide an ROE award that pleases them, or are you responsible to the citizens of North Dakota to ensure that they pay rates sufficient but no more than sufficient to allow the company to attract capital and maintain credit? If your responsibility is to the citizens of North Dakota, then you will award a 9% return regardless of what the investment community thinks of it. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. King. The witness is available for cross-examination.
Thank you. Mr. Johnson?
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning, Mr. King.
Good morning.
I'm going to direct your attention to a few topics as we go along, and as I move from topic to topic, I'll try to make that apparent so that we keep talking about the same thing at the same time. And let's start with your opening statement here. At the base of the second page, you have a reference, and I guess also in your direct testimony, to your peer group stock prices.
Yes.
As of what date was that?
Well, let's see. The market price was 60 days previous to, and you'll find this at the footnote of Exhibit CWK 2, Schedule 2. It's average closing prices during the April 29 through June 25.
Thank you. Would you agree with me that utility stock prices have slid recently?
I don't know whether they have or not.
You have not checked that.
I'm sorry?
You have not checked that?
No.
In your opening statement, you presented an argument talking about the relative book values of the peers and of Xcel Energy.
Yes.
I don't recall you having discussed that in your direct testimony. Did I miss something?
No.
Now, on page 8 of your direct testimony, lines 4 and 5, you talk about the implications of a prior analysis, and I believe that analysis was largely concerning interest rates and their movement.
Yes.
Am I correct?
Yes.
And you state at page 8, lines 7 and 8, that the desirability of utility stocks to other forms of investment has increased with the decline of interest rates. The increase in desirability and consequent decrease in demand has driven up the prices of utility stocks.
That's right.
So declining interest rates drive up utility stocks. Is it fair for me to conclude that rising interest rates have the opposite effect?
That's true. The estimate has been that for every 1 percentage point increase in the Treasury bond rate, 30-year Treasury bond rate, mm-hmm. that the cost of equity goes up about 0.3%. And I don't have that study with me, and I'm not even sure I subscribe to it, but that's an indication of the mm-hmm. of the trend.
30 basis points, 0.3%.
30 basis points for a 100 basis point change in the Treasury bond rate.
Thank you. And thinking about how prices of utility stocks affect the cost of equity analysis, is it correct that an increase in prices decreases dividend yields, holding all other factors equal?
Yes.
And accordingly, a reduction in the dividend yields would tend to reduce the calculated cost of equity under the DCF model.
That's correct.
Now, you've indicated that your recognition that interest rates are increasing, but you have characterized two of those interest rate increases from July to current date, those being the 30-year Treasuries and the Moody's BAA index.
Yes.
Your Honor, I'd like to have an exhibit marked and then approach the witness.
You may.
Thank you.
I will label this. Oh, I have, maybe I just have two copies. Is it two pages?
No, it's 2 pages. I believe you do have 2 copies.
Thank you. I will label this PSC Exhibit 35.
PSC or NSP?
NSP.
What did I say?
PSC.
Let's try NSP 35. Thank you. I'll let you identify, have the witness identify it before we offer it.
I have it.
Can you identify that Mr. King?
Well, I think it's a chart of yields on the 30-year Treasury bond.
Your Honor, I would move admission of this document into evidence.
Thank you. Any objection?
No, Your Honor.
Thank you. NSP Exhibit 35 is admitted. Continue, please.
Mr. King, just so that everyone understands what this is, it's my understanding that this is from Yahoo Finance and that it is a one-year look at 30-year Treasury yields.
Yep.
And you can tell it's the one-year look because the little square below the graph, the one that says 1Y, is colored in.
Yes.
Okay. And it's my understanding that this shows dividend yield changes in the 30-year Treasury from approximately August of 2012 through August of 2013.
That's correct.
So by way of perspective, the July to August change, excuse me, that you were talking about is sort of in the two, I don't know, bars, chart, columns, whatever you'd want to call them on the right, and the history from prior periods is to the left of that.
That's correct.
Now, it would be my interpretation that over time, and based on our conversation, that as the interest yields have increased for the 30-year treasuries, the relative desirability of utility stocks as an investment would have decreased.
Well, of all stocks would have decreased somewhat.
But we were talking about utilities earlier.
Yes, right? Yes.
Okay.
But it would apply to all stocks.
Your Honor, may I have a second exhibit marked?
Yes, you may.
Thank you. Your Honor, I do move admission of.
We did admit 35.
I apologize, Your Honor.
That's fine. This will be marked NSP Exhibit 36.
Thank you.
Thank you. All right, I believe we have those.
Thank you, Your Honor. Mr. King, I'd like to direct your attention to what's been marked NSP 36. Can you identify that for me?
Well, let's see. It's from somebody called Fred. And it's a Moody's Season BAA Corporate Bond Yields Source Governors, Board of Governors, Federal Reserve System. It appears to be, I guess these are monthly data. It's a line that shows the monthly change in yields on BAA corporate bonds.
And this is from the St. Louis Federal Reserve?
I guess that's what it is. I'm just reading the web page. Yes, I guess that's what that is. St. Louis Fed.
Your Honor, I would move receipt into evidence of this.
Any objections, Mr. Norell?
No, Your Honor.
Thank you. NSP Exhibit 36 is admitted.
And this appears to show the change in the Moody's BAA corporates. I don't know that this is the utilities, but this is the corporates.
Yes, it's all corporate bonds.
And this would show the changes in all corporate bonds from the beginning of 2012 through August of 2013.
I think it's July of 2013.
You're right. I apologize. July of 2013. Now, you were in your direct testimony at page 9. You indicated a criticism, I believe. I'll characterize it as that. Regarding decisions by other state utility entities in 2012, and you characterized it as a persistent disbelief that interest rates could stay as low as they have for as long as they have.
That's right.
It would appear that at this point anyway, interest rates are in fact no longer holding at the low levels. They are increasing.
Not as low as they have been. They're still quite low. And I don't think they'll go a whole lot higher because the Fed has been very emphatic that they're not going to allow a significant increase in interest rates as long as unemployment is as low as it is now.
Other analysts are, in fact, predicting fairly substantial increases in the treasuries, are they not?
Well, they have been predicting substantial increases in treasuries and in interest rates in general for years. And month after month after month, those forecasts have proved to be overstated. And I can demonstrate that if you would like.
Mr. King, let's go back to NSP 36 for a moment.
Which one is that?
That's the 30-year treasuries.
Okay.
And you described your DCF analysis as using stock price data from the period of June 25, I believe, going back 60 days.
That's correct. Just happened to be when I did this analysis.
I appreciate that. I believe you were using almost most current data available at that time, were you not?
Yes.
However, looking at NSP 36, it would appear that by happenstance, and I'll characterize it that way, you caught a particularly low ebb in utility stock prices for your analysis.
Well, I don't know that. I got a particularly low ebb in Treasury bond yields.
Fair enough.
There's no indication. Unless you have an exhibit showing utility stock prices, I can't confirm that.
Other than the characteristics we talked about earlier, which is that low yields lead to high utility prices and vice versa.
It's a general proposition, but before I admit or even imply that utility stock prices have declined significantly, I'd like to see the evidence. You may be right, but I don't know that that's the case.
The principles we talked about would suggest that's the case, would they not?
Yeah, but I don't want to buy onto that suggestion unless it's demonstrated, and maybe you have a demonstration.
It was in your testimony.
It was in what was in my testimony?
The principles we were articulating a moment ago.
Well, I don't know that it was in my it is true. The principles are in my testimony. What is not true is that I agree that stock prices have declined significantly in response to these Treasury bond yield increases during the last few months.
I have no other questions. Thank you, Your Honor.
All right. Thank you. I believe the order of testimony then now comes, or questioning comes to Mr. Norrell. No, I'm sorry. We'll go to the commission. Ms. Fedorchik.
I don't have any questions, so it's okay. Yeah.
Okay. Sorry. Yesterday it was so clear. All right.
Judge, you have to sit on this side.
The new routine.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Little, spatial disorientation. All right, Commissioner Fedorchik.
I'll start with your test or your opening statement, Mr. King. Just for some clarification, you say here that Ms. Bulkley admits that as interest rates increase, the spread between bond yields and stock returns narrows. And if that's the case, then the 20-point increase in interest rates translates to a much smaller increase in ROE requirements. Can you explain what you mean by that? If you need to just
well, it's been demonstrated, indicated. When I say demonstrated, it implies that we know absolutely what stock return requirements are. But it has been demonstrated that at least the apparent return on stocks increases as interest rates increase, but not at the same rate. That if you have an increase in Treasury bond rates like we see here,
mm-hmm.
the increase in required returns will not be as steep. It'll be much lower. It'll only be, according to the study I've seen, about 30% of the increase in in Treasury bond. Now, if Treasury bonds go up 20 points, that's 0.20%, then that means that the yield on utility stocks would go up only 0.06%.
Okay, if you wouldn't mind, I'm big into examples. Use a real example, like a treasury bond and a utility stock, and some prices.
We have between July and now, mid-July and now, a 20 basis point increase in treasury bond yields. That's in my statement. Mm-hmm. In that time, the utility or overall stock return requirement will have increased, but not as much. It will have increased 0.6% or 6 basis points.
Then how does this tie to a smaller increase in ROE?
Well, because the return to stock prices is ROE. It is return on equity being
right.
Stock.
All right. Do you think, talk to me a little bit about your proposal at 9% and the company's proposal at 10.25. Scratch that. Currently they get 10.4 and you're recommending 9%.
Yes.
Talk to me about how you feel that jump, will look to investors. How does that large of a swing, or maybe you don't think it's a large swing, reflect sure. on this on investors?
Be sure investors will squeal. They will think it's terrible. But the issue I have is your constituency investors? To hear Ms. Buckley talk, your concern is making investors happy. Well, if you want to make investors happy, by all means, stay at 10.4. But your responsibility is to the citizens of North Dakota. And your job is to set this rate of return where it should be. That is minimum required to recover, to maintain credit maintain credit and attract capital. As a practical matter, it probably won't have much effect on XL because North Dakota is very small potatoes in the total scope of things. But we're not supposed to think that way. We're supposed to assume that we are setting a new rate of return for the entire company. And it is true that if you set the rate at 9%, you will get a lot of flack from the investor community, and probably the company's stock, hypothetically, would go down. But that's as it should be, because the company has been over-rewarded. It has been given a rate of return too high. I don't want to criticize you all, but 10.4 is much too high, at least now. Maybe it was better when you awarded it. Okay. But you have to bite the bullet and set the rate at what the minimum investors require, because you'll hear howls from investors. What you won't hear howls from are those folks down in the trailer court who now have to pay $6 a month more for their electricity, and they can't afford it. I think those are the people that you have a responsibility to concern yourself with.
Okay. Then what do you say to the company's assertion that the ratepayers are affected by a increased borrowing costs?
First of all, I don't think their company's borrowing costs will be affected one bit. Borrowing costs are a function of a lot of ratios, a return on equity being only one of them. It has to do with the coverage of interest charges. It has to do with free cash flow, which would include depreciation and deferred taxes as well as return on equity. I would question whether there's going to be any significant change in the company's borrowing costs, even if we hypothesize that the total return to XL would go down to 9%.
I've been sort of intrigued by the difference between the allowed return and the actual return, and wondering why there's so much emphasis on what we allow by the investment community versus them looking at what they actually are going to make by the historical, you know, by the past couple of years, the company hasn't been meeting its allowable returns.
Well, the concern is that what you allow is a starting point. In other words, you allow 10.4 and they only earn just under 9. The presumption is if you allow 9, they'll only earn under you know, about 7.5. The way I think you repair this is try and come up with a rate of return, I mean a decision that allows them to actually earn the 9%. And that will offset to some degree the perception that you're anti-investor. If you can make sure this company is actually able to earn that 9%, investors will be a lot happier than if you give them 10.5 or, well, 10.25, and then they don't have a chance of earning it. Mm-hmm. I think that's the kind of confidence that investors would much prefer than just the flat-out award.
I am interested in that. So what do we do to get to that?
That's the other piece of this whole rate case that I'm not involved in. The revenue requirement guys are the ones to talk to about that.
Okay. And then my last question to you is, were you here yesterday when Mr. Tyson
yes.
testified? Give me your thoughts on his comments.
Well, Mr. Tyson is a employee of Xcel. And Xcel's interest is maximizing profit. He's going to give you the picture solely from the standpoint of investors in Xcel. And what he's going to try and tell you is that if the company makes a big return, it's going to be wonderful for ratepayers. Well, it's wonderful for ratepayers if the company makes a return sufficient to attract capital and maintain credit, which a 9% return will do. It's even more wonderful for the company if they make way over that. And that is not good for ratepayers. Ratepayers need the minimum return necessary to maintain credit and attract capital. But they shouldn't pay a red cent more. And that's the nut I'm asking you to bite. Namely, go down to what is the minimum, even though it isn't the conventional wisdom of the regulatory community.
What do you think of what would you think of a compromise that sets a higher return on than what you're recommending, but requires that if the company exceeds it, it shares in its excess earnings with the ratepayers?
A lot of commissions have done that. Usually when they have multi-year awards, Georgia, for example, only has a one rate case every 3 years, and they do a projection of the next year's revenue requirement the year after and the year after. And then there is a set rate of return, and there is a dead band around it, usually of about a half a percentage point. Let's say they set 10%. And if the company earns over 10.5, anything over that, they have to share with ratepayers. And similarly, if they go under that, then they get a bump in their rates. That's a multi-year kind of thing. Now, on a one-year go, I don't think you would – that doesn't make as much sense.
Mm-hmm.
In Maine, it's even more exaggerated. They go out 5 years have these kind of adjustments for dead band plus sharing above a dead band and dead band plus – it isn't an automatic rate increase. They have to come back in for it. But they have the right to jump ahead of the five-year schedule if they don't make if they go below the dead band. It's a feature you could think about.
Mm-hmm. And just to kind of take the extreme scenario, say we went with the 9%, and the company couldn't raise capital to
If there were a demonstration that the company couldn't raise capital, then I think the 9% would be too low. But I just don't think that's going to be the case. I don't see how it could be the case.
Okay. That's all for me for now.
Thank you, Commissioner Fedorchik, Chairman Conk.
Thank you, Your Honor. Thank you, Mr. King, for your testimony. And the same thing I told the previous witness, thanks for coming out here and helping us out. It's always good to get different perspectives. Commissioner Fedorchik opened up some questions I wanted to explore a little bit further. The concept you were just talking about earning shares above a certain point, we've used that in previous orders, and I think that's a good idea. But I'd never thought about the idea on the other side, the undershares, if you will. Can you walk me through that again? I know you talked about it. Give me a little more detail how that would flesh out.
Well, the theory of it is that if you give an award for a multi-year award and you set a rate of return, and if the company over-earns that return, it shares with the ratepayers. If it under-earns that return, it has a constitutional, and I'm not a lawyer, but it's my understanding, it has a constitutional right to get more money. In other words, it becomes a taking by the commission where the company is forced to hold its prices down to a point where it can't cover its costs.
So how would that practice? Because when we've seen cases where companies have over-earned and at the end of the year they submit us paperwork that says we over-earned by this amount and we've already got an agreement in place and let's say half of it goes back to the customers. It's pretty easy to figure that out.
Yeah.
So if we set it for the under-earn, would it be the same thing? The company would file their under-earnings?
No. You can't do that. It tends not to work symmetrically, I'm afraid.
Well, how,
if you under-earn, then they have to demonstrate that they how much more money they have to come in. It's a matter of probably law that you can't increase rates without some demonstration.
Sure, but are these – again, we can explore this more in the work session, I guess, but the – it's not certainly going through another rate case like this. It could be a procedure you'd think to be more of a 45-day window where the company would file.
It could be something shorter than that.
Because the not to give out all my cards here too early, but I would certainly like to get to a point with all of our investor-owned utilities where we're not having rate cases every year. I'd like to get to at least a 3-year period, maybe even longer.
Yeah.
But the challenge is figuring out an ROE that you could predict for that period of time. How would you envision something like that, where if my goal is to have a rate case no more than every 3 years, how would you structure an ROE given the variability that can take place in that 3-year period?
Well, what I would do is tie the ROE to the Treasury bond rate. And this is being recommended in Maine, where they have a 5-year window. The proposal, and it hasn't been adopted yet, is that there's a dead band of Treasury bond changes of 100 basis points. In other words, from the get-go, as long as the Treasury bond yield does not change more than 100 basis points, and right now it is, 3.8? As long as it doesn't exceed 4.8, there's no change in the allowed return. If it exceeds 4.8, then the allowed return on equity to the company increases by approximately 30 basis points. And that's that 1 to 0.3 relationship I was talking about, where the return on equity doesn't increase at the rate that the Treasury bond yield increases. And from then on, every annual change in the Treasury bond yield gets a 0.3% change up or down in the allowed return for that year.
So the ROE that you're recommending today is 9.0.
Yeah.
How long do you feel comfortable that that's the right amount?
Well, the company's telegraphed pretty clearly.
No, what do you think?
What do I think?
What do you think?
I just can't say.
But that,
if there is a dramatic increase in interest rates, obviously the ROE of 9% is not appropriate. But it's got to be a fairly hefty increase in interest rates.
So 1 year? Do you think 1 year is fair?
I would say certainly for 1 year.
Okay.
But the company's telegraphed to you that they're going to be in here next year. and you'll be looking at this whole thing all over again, unfortunately.
The were you here when I talked yesterday with Ms. Ann Bulkley?
Yes.
Are you familiar with what advanced determination of prudence is?
Yes.
What would your thoughts be on if levying a company an advanced determination of prudence should affect the ROE?
Well, if the fact that you issue these reduces the risk of new investment and therefore lowers the demand for ROE, I mean the requirement.
But did you determine, did you include the fact that this commission has been very favorable to ADPs in your calculation of the return on equity?
No, I did not. Not explicitly.
So if you had viewed a commission more favorably for ROE, vice one that not favorably, how much do you think that could sway your ROE calculation?
Well, Ms. Buckley was right that it's a matter of comparison. I use 16 companies, and I'd have to look at all those 16 companies to see whether they also issue ADPs. Okay. And if they do, then the fact that you issue ADPs won't have much effect. On the other hand, if 15 of them don't and you do, then it's a significant a reduction in risk that's discrete only to NSP and should be recognized in the return on equity.
Okay, thank you. And then the last question, the company now is asking for a rate increase of roughly 9.25%. And they're given interim rates right now. How do you see the relationship between the actual rate increase they get to the return on equity? How do you see that relationship?
Oh, well, the lower the return on equity, the lower will be the rate increase. If they're
I couldn't separate and give them a rate increase of 11%, but a return on equity of 9%.
You'd have to offset it with something else. You have to do some disallowing. You're talking about disallowing all those renewable energy projects. We'll have a go at that. That would be an offset. But all things being equal, you can't give them a high return and a lower rate increase.
Unless we make something else along the way.
Yeah.
Maybe that'll happen. You never know. So,
well,
all right. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner. Commissioner Christman.
Mr. King, in our discussion yesterday with Ms. Bulkley about the downgrading of South Dakota and Minnesota. And
yes.
We talked about whether that was, or I asked the question whether it was purely because of the ROEs. Are you familiar with
yes.
with that those decisions, and was that a the only factor or a major factor or just one of many factors in those downgrades
in
your opinion?
Certainly won't be the only factor. It is a major factor, but it's not the only factor. I mentioned to Commissioner Fedorchak.
There you go.
Now I've lost my train of thought. Working on your name. Get me back on track, please.
Correlation between the lower ROEs and the downgrading of
the jurisdiction. Even with a low rate of return, if the probability of earning that return is significantly greater in North Dakota than elsewhere, then I think that's an offsetting consideration that might improve their view of North Dakota's regulation. It's not just the absolute level of rate of return, but what they call a quality of regulation, whether regulation tends to have inconsistent from case to case disallowances or treatments of various costs that can't be forecast or anticipated by the investment community, that makes for a very unstable and unreliable form of regulation. There is some point to consistency. But it is true, though, that the allowed return is a major factor in setting these regulatory environments. Now, again, remember that the regulatory environments is purely from the investor standpoint. And I submit that the investors are not necessarily your constituency.
And I appreciated that clarity at the end of your statement today. But I do want to ask one more question on that, on from the perspective of the investors. Am I understanding you right that if everything else is done well, a 9% ROE would not necessarily cause a downgrade? If the rest of our regulatory environment,
I can't promise you that, but certainly it would reduce the likelihood.
Okay. When we talk about this, we talk about kind of a us versus them relationship between the investors and the ratepayers. Is there some rule of thumb that, or does this have to do with the 1% to 0.3% correlation you were talking about? The difference between what a ratepayer would expect they're going to have to pay at 10.25% versus 9%. How do I translate that difference to a ratepayer that approaches me on the street?
Well, the ratepayer that approaches you on the street neither knows nor cares what the rate of return is. What he's worried about is their electric bill. And if the electric bill goes up 9%, which incidentally is multiples of the rate of inflation, and it comes on top of other rate increases, both past and future, that apparently are multiples of the rate inflation, that's what he cares about. And the difference between 10.25 and 9 is reflected in that rate increase. If you go 9% instead of 10.25, you have a much smaller rate increase, and that's the thing that the ratepayer cares about.
But is there a number that one could put to just that part of the discussion? All the things we're going to end up dealing with in this whole rate case, when it gets down to the difference between 10.25 or 9%, what is the impact of that part of the puzzle?
You know, I have that to a ratepayer in my data requests here. I asked them what a 1% difference in return on equity equals, and I have to look it up. If I could find it quickly, I'll try and do that. Oh, here it is. I'll find it for you. Here's the question I asked. Please provide a quantification of the net change in NSPM's revenue requirement that results from a 1%, 100 basis point change in the allowed cost of equity. And it says the result is a theoretical 1% change in the cost of equity is a reduction in the revenue requirement request in this proceeding of approximately $3.2 million. Now, we're at a 1.25 difference, so think maybe, 3.5, $3.6 million out of the – what? How much are they asking for? $14
million?
So that's the impact.
Okay. Thank you, Adam, for the questions.
All right. Thank you. Ms. Jeffcoat-Sackle, any questions? And then we'll come back to Mr. Norrell and make the rounds.
Okay. I do, but I thought I'd wait till my turn came up. You've said several times that the commission's job is to find that number that is the minimum required, and I always thought the objective was a reasonable number as opposed to a minimum number.
Well, that's the reasonable number. The reasonable number, in my opinion, and maybe others have different views, is the number that allows the utility to raise capital and maintain credit, but it should be no higher than that number, because that's the number that best balances the interest of ratepayers and the interest of the company.
Do you have the docket number in Maine that you're referring to, where apparently they're looking at the sharing mechanism?
I can get it for you. It's underway. What happened is the company filed a rate application They were looking for a capital budget writer or tracker, and the commission rejected that out of hand. And so the company has to refile. And so the whole case has been put back. But part of the case is this proposal for a tracker for the 30-year Treasury. I haven't talked to – I represent the consumer advocate there, and I haven't talked to them, but my personal preference is to favor it because I think it reduces the risk of – well, it reduces the company's risk and therefore reduces the required rate of return.
So it is for one company, though. It's not like a generic –
It's
a
Central Main Power.
Okay. And if you could get the docket number during one of the breaks or something, that would be helpful.
I can get it right off my computer.
Okay. And then we did have one further question. Perhaps you should take a minute to explain the difference between your recommended capital structure and in a summary fashion, your recommended capital structure and the companies and what sort of impact that has if it's large or small to this question.
Well, I know what I use, and I can't right off remember what the company used, but what I used was the latest actual capital structure. There is a propensity of utilities to forecast capital structures, and I don't really know how they do that. They forecast capital structures, and they forecast the costs of those capital structures, particularly the cost of debt. Now, we've been talking about the uncertainty of future interest rate changes. And I have pointed out that there's been a propensity to overstate future interest rates. That adds a new area of uncertainty into the whole finding of rate of return. So my preference and the thing I urge on all commissions that I testify before is to use the latest actual capital structure. I believe I use the capital structure as of... Okay.
I wrote it in March 2013.
Do you want to identify that piece of paper?
I don't see the capital structure on here.
Isn't it that?
Oh, up here. Okay, I've got that.
What it doesn't
tell me is when this... Oh, this is 2011 actual.
But this was yours.
Oh, March 13, 2003.
13.
2013, I'm sorry.
You want to identify that piece of paper?
This is Exhibit AEH1, Schedule 3, page 5 of 6 that I'm looking at.
And Commissioner Fedorchuk just handed that to you.
She wrote in the March 2013 capital structure. And the capital structure that I used... is an Exhibit CWK1... And it's March 31.
Same one.
This is the capital structure I use. Now, I don't know what the company used right off the top of my head.
The one you used is company actual, March 31, or your recommended?
No, it's company actual, March 31. I got it out of the Form 10-Q that the company files with the SEC.
Okay. Thanks. That's all.
Thank you. Mr. Norell.
Thank you, Your Honor. Mr. King, you had mentioned yesterday you were here when Mr. Tyson testified via telephone. And do you recall he stated approximately two-thirds of the investors in the company are institutional investors and only one-third are individual investors?
Yes.
In your opinion, do individual investors actually look at things like rate of return when they're investing in companies such as this, or is it more likely that they would buy utility stocks because they have historically been thought of as a secure investment?
Well, probably individual customers buy them because they're secure and they tend to have high-ish dividend yields. The institutional investors are probably more analytical in their purchases and do go into the issues of return on equity allowances and so on.
You've mentioned numerous times there's a tendency to overstate future interest rates. Can you give us an example of that? Or?
Well, I've got a chart here, which you can hand out. I did have a chart, which shows, have you got that chart?
I think I
Here it is.
May I hand this chart out? It's marked as Exhibit CWK, but I don't believe it's been pre-filed. No, it has not. So,
and it's not in the testimony.
It is not.
This All right. Exhibit.
Come forward with that, please, Mr. Norell.
Seek to admit it as a hearing exhibit.
Yes, this would be labeled PSC Exhibit 18. And have the witness identify this, and then I'll see if there's any objections.
This is a chart which shows the forecast 18 months prior to the actual by the what's called Blue Chip Financial Forecast. Blue Chip is an organization that...
But don't testify, just identify it.
Trying to identify what Blue Chip is.
No, the document says Blue Chip Financial Forecasts for
30-year oh, right.
Treasury bonds. All right, at this time, Mr. Johnson, any objections?
No, Your Honor, but I will be very interested to find out what this is as Mr. King is going forward with.
Okay. And at the very least, Mr. Norell, have the witness identify who prepared this or where this came from.
Yes.
All right. Exhibit PSC 18 is admitted.
Mr. King, could you please identify who prepared this and where the information
well,
came from?
Well, I prepared it. We subscribe to a service called Blue Chip Financial Forecast. It's a monthly publication of the consensus of a whole raft of different analysts. It's not just securities analysts. They go to universities. They have 30 or 40 people that they ask questions about what they expect. And these among the questions they ask, and this is a bunch of others, is what is the forecast that you have for 30-year Treasury bonds in the next quarter, the next quarter, the next quarter, and the next quarter, out 6 quarters, which is 18 months. So what I did was I went through and my old copies of these reports, and I identify when the forecast was made and for what quarter. And you will see the forecast made in January 2008 was for the second quarter of 2009, and the forecast was for 4.9%. That's the top line. And then I went and looked up in the Federal Reserve historical record what the actual Treasury bond yield was. And in the case of that month, the actual was 4.17. And I did that for each of the monthly forecasts from January 2008 through December 2011, which got me to forecast to the first quarter of 2013. And what it shows is that except for a period of about 3 months, rather, forecasts, Blue Chip is consistently forecast interest rates significantly higher than ones that actually developed 18 months later. And that's the basis of my statement that the forecasts have been consistently overstated relative to the actuals.
Thank you, Your Honor. I have no further questions.
Thank you, Mr. Norell. Mr. Johnson, recross.
Yes, thank you, Your Honor. Mr. King, let's stay on this topic here for a moment because I'm not sure I yet understand. So the data ranges for at the base of the page pertain to the actual
well, you go to
Treasury
the,
yields, or is that the forecast? It appears
well,
to be the actuals.
Take a look at the top. You see 4 quarter. It says the top line says 2209, 2009, 4.9. And that's the forecast. And then the next column is the actual for that quarter.
Okay. So that helps. So what you did was you cut off your data, and I don't mean that in any editorial sense, but your data ends as for the actual Treasury bond yields in the first quarter of 2013, I understand.
And that's because, I have to confess, our subscription ran out and I didn't renew it.
Fair enough. So if we were to extend this through the recent rise in Treasury yields, we may get the same or a different result.
Well, in preparing this case, I resubscribe, but I haven't yet gotten the reports. Among the things I've got to do when I get to my office is phone them up and say, where are my reports?
And I appreciate that. I was trying to figure out the implications of this. The recent rise in Treasury yields is not reflected in this data as compared to what forecasts were.
No.
And is it correct that analysts or investors, if you will, look at both actual data and forecast data?
That's correct.
So even though the forecasters are consistently wrong per your chart here, investors would be looking at that and giving it whatever weight they thought it deserved.
Yeah, but in this case, I'm concerned about basing a rate of return finding on forecasts that have consistently proven exaggerated. Ms. Bulkley goes out to 2016, 2018, something like that, in her in a couple of her models, coming up with the Treasury bond yield that she's going to use as her risk-free rate in both the interest rate risk premium methodology and in the capital asset pricing study. She uses these far-out forecasts, which I don't think you can forecast interest rates that far out with any reliability, regardless of what the trends are. And second, the pattern has been for over-forecasting.
However, I believe a moment ago we did agree that investors, whether they're wise or not wise, do look at that data.
Yeah, they do, but I'm concerned this commission not.
And isn't it correct that the real goal here is to determine what investors require? Hasn't this commission said that in so many words?
Well, in forecasting the growth rates, that's what we do look at. In using the capital asset pricing model and in using the interest rate risk premium, that's not based on investor forecasts or investor expectations. That's based on the actual risk-free rate.
And Mr. King, I was not referring to a particular model. Isn't it correct that this commission has said the ultimate test for the ROE is what investors require?
It's what investors require, but you got to realize that Ms. Bulkley's 10.25% return estimate is based on, to some measure, on these very exaggerated future Treasury bond yields.
Which investors rely on degree.
No.
I thought a moment ago we agreed on that.
No, what I said is that the two cases in which she uses these forecasts have nothing to do with investor expectations. They are estimates of the added cost of stocks over risk-free rate, and she set the risk-free rate at an unreasonably high level, which had – the risk-free rate is what it is. It isn't what investors expect it to be.
So those comments you've just made are now addressed to the CAPM model and the risk premium model.
Exactly.
Thank you. Earlier on, you had some discussion, and you articulated your view on what the appropriate ROE was, which you characterize as the minimum needed to raise capital and maintain financial integrity.
That's correct.
And I believe you characterize that as not following the conventional wisdom of the regulatory community.
Not necessarily following it, yes.
If I'm an investor and I have two investments of comparable risk, one in a environment, or excuse me, a jurisdiction that has a more a higher view of the appropriate ROE than North Dakota, assuming it were to follow your recommendation, what incentive would I have to invest in North Dakota when I could get a higher authorized ROE elsewhere?
Well, an investor looking at a series of utilities can't buy the book value. He can buy only the market value, which is significantly less than the return on book value. When you give an excessive rate of return on book value, the effect of that is to bid up the market price. And the market price is what the investor it has to pay. And it is significantly lower than the book return if the market-to-book ratio is well over one. So the investor doesn't look at the return on book values. He looks at the return on market value, which arguably is equal for all utilities of comparable risk. The difference is that the utility that gets the high rate of return has a very high stock price. The utility that gets the lower rate of return has a lower stock price. But from the investor's viewpoint, the return is the same.
So you're suggesting that a investor will get the same return with a 9% ROE as with a 10.25?
If the stock price of the one of the company with a 10.25 is proportionately higher than that differential, the answer is the same return.
That would be the market-to-book discussion we had
exactly.
earlier.
Exactly.
Let's just clear up one point here. You had some discussion about the effect of a 1% change in the ROE, and you quoted a response provided by the company. That would be about $3.2 million.
Yes, for 1%.
Right. And if we were to take that 3.2 number and multiply it by 1.25, I believe that would reflect the additional 25 basis points swing, would it not?
That's right.
My calculation leads to a $4.0 million impact rather than the 3.5 you sort of
I was just winging
estimated,
it.
Right?
I try not to overstate it,
right.
But if that's what the calculation is, it's $4 million.
Thank you. That's all I have, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. This time we'll go to the commission. Commissioner Fedorchuk.
Yeah, Ms. Jeffcoat-Sacco was talking about the company's capital structure, and we didn't actually get to the part where you were going to talk about the differences. So I found the official, not my scribbled in, references to both the companies and yours, and if you could speak to... They aren't significant differences, but they are different, and I'd like to know what the impact of that is. So the companies is on page 41 of Ms. Bulkley's testimony in a chart, and then yours is on exhibit.
Mrs. Bulkley's initial testimony or rebuttal?
Rebuttal.
Rebuttal, okay.
Yeah, rebuttal testimony. And I have that, okay.
Oh, dear. I have an implied growth rates on utility sector. Maybe I'm in the wrong place. It isn't the initial? Let me see.
Oh, yes, it is the initial. Did it change, though? Would it have changed?
Yeah, I've got it here. Here's the trouble. I don't really know what the basis of Ms. Bulkley's capital structure is.
I'm mostly interested in your explanation of what the differences in how these are structured, and they're fairly small, what you're proposing, what they are, what the effect is, and why should we be concerned about it?
Well, obviously, Ms. Bulkley's capital structure is different from mine because mine is – as of a date later than Ms. Bulkley's initial testimony. So right off the bat, that would explain some of the difference. Whether she used a historical capital structure or a forecast one, I just don't know. I can't tell from this.
So you can't speak to what the effects those differences
have? Well, the effect of the difference is that I can speak to. 1 minute. she has a equity percentage. Well, the biggest difference is she has an equity percentage of 44.96%. I have one of 45.24. Mm-hmm. And the effect of that is, oh, that was debt, I'm sorry, not equity. The effect of having a little more debt is to lower the composite rate of return. She has a common equity proportion of 52.56%. I have a common equity proportion of 53.42%. And the fact that I have a slightly higher equity proportion means that cost of capital, composite cost of capital, would be slightly higher had I used her her ratio. I have less short-term debt, which has the effect of increasing my composite rate of return. I think the overall difference, to sum it up, is that using my rate of my capital structure probably increases by a couple basis points the overall rate of return.
Okay, thank you.
And I could work through it and give you a precise number if you'd like.
Sure, that would be helpful.
Let me do that over the break.
Okay, thank you. That's all my questions. Thanks.
Thank you, Commissioner. Commissioner Kalk? No, ma'am. Thank you, Commissioner Chrisman.
I have no further questions either.
All right, thank you, Commissioner. Ms. Jeffcoat-Sacco, any further questions?
Just one. Based on that, because I thought I understood, you are not recommending revisions to the capital structure as part of your recommendation. You're not recommending they have too much equity or too much debt or anything like that. You were just using different numbers based on a different date.
That's the only effective difference.
Okay. That's what I wanted to clear up. Thank you. That's all.
All right. Thank you. And Mr. Norrell, any further questions?
No, Your Honor. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Johnson, any further questions?
No, Your Honor.
Commissioners, any further questions from any of the commissioners? All right. Hearing none, you're excused.
Thank you.
All right. Are we ready to proceed to the next witness, or does the commission want a five-minute break? All right. We'll take 5 minutes.
It'll take 5 minutes for me to get all this crap out of here.
Well, that's good timing
Okay, that's right.
Yeah. Not room.
Oh, not.